Joe Hart signed for Manchester City at the age of 19. 4 Premier League Golden Gloves later, the goalkeeper has amassed 73 international caps and spent the majority of his career as England's number one. During his time at City, he's won 2 Premier League titles, an FA Cup and 2 League Cups. But not part of current manager Pep Guardiola's plans, he's openly admitted his next silverware will have to come from elsewhere.
The Offside Rule Exclusives with Kate Borsay and Lindsay Hooper.
This is the Offside Rule Exclusives with Joe Hart, guest edited for this episode by another England goalkeeper, this time for England women, Carly Telford, who's set you some questions. Joe's with us now, myself, Kate Borsay, Lindsay Hooper. We've met in a hotel in Canary Wharf, where Joe lives nearby. First thing I've got to say, Joe, this is a funny place to find a footballer. Do you get on with men in suits? Do you like the whole business environment? Because it wouldn't be the first place that I'd think of for a footballer of your calibre to reside.
It works for me. It's perfect for the training ground. I don't have to fight any traffic to get to it. Also, the stadium's close. And I think it's a really nice place to live. People tried to put me off. They tried to say that, you know, what you just said, but there's loads more to it. It's a good environment, don't get me wrong, there is a lot of suits walking around, but now we feel really comfortable here.
I can tell that Joe's never been to the Tube at 8:30 in the morning. Joe, it's mental. It's like lots of little ants running around. Joe, let's go into this by talking a little bit about you as a young footballer and your dad as well, who identified, so I gather, your ability from a very young age. Is it right that you were catching and throwing balls from the age of 2?
I don't know. That's what's said, but I've always loved sport, anything to do with a ball or a football or a cricket ball or a tennis ball. Mum said that, you know, I wasn't really interested in any kind of fancy toys. That was all I wanted, and, you know, not much has changed.
A few people who've looked into your career before have picked up on the cricket connection. And it was very close that you were going to go down a cricketing route rather than football at one point, I believe. But also you actually shared some time with people who went on to play for England, didn't you?
Yeah, I played to a decent level, and I really enjoyed playing cricket. And I still love the sport and the game. I was getting some opportunities around the age of 16. I didn't have a nailed-on cricket career. I wasn't literally decided between one or the other, but I had options to explore, a better education and with a cricketing option tied in, or the football route. And the football route felt like the right one for me, and it worked out well.
I'm from a part of the world that's not so far from where you're originally from, and you started your career at one club. And I just want to clear this up, because having been a football reporter up and down the country, the amount of times I hear this place said different ways. Yeah. And their nickname is the Shrews. So can you clarify once and for all, is it Shrewsbury?
I've always known it as Shrewsbury, but it depends what you think of yourself. You can call it, you can call it Shrewsbury if you really want, but... I've always grown up in Shrewsbury, playing for Shrewsbury Town, but there's different ways of saying it. Like I say, depending on how what you think of yourself.
Your career at Shrewsbury was unprecedented, really, at the time. You locally became well known. Your manager at the time had great things to say about you, and unsurprisingly, quite a few clubs came down to have a look at you. City was the one that you went with at the age of 19. What was it about City that was right for you at that time? And did you ever envisage having such a long career with them?
You know, like you said, there was a lot of interest, but I think that's because I was just a young player, especially for my age, playing men's football. So it was quite interesting for people to come down and see, but I stayed away from it, really. I let my agent, who I'm still with now, deal with that situation. And we kind of let it play out the best way it could. And Man City had the strongest interest. Stuart Pearce and Tim Flowers at the time, made contact. And I think it worked out the best way it was going to do. There was no huge plans. I turned up there as a number 3, going to learn how to play football at the top level, and potentially go out on loan, potentially play for the first team. And it was then in my hands. They gave me the opportunity to go there, and I'm grateful for that. And Shrewsbury eventually let that happen. It was, there was a few hairy moments, but that's football. But we got there in the end.
At the age of 19, to kind of attract, and probably earlier than that as well, to attract attention from major clubs, no matter how level-headed you are, that's a pivotal point in your career, isn't it? And you can be as level-headed as you want, but you must have... you must have realised the enormity of the move that you're about to make.
Yeah, I did, but it was a different move for me. I wasn't a 19-year-old going in to play immediate Premier League football. We see potential in you. We want to work with you, but it's kind of down to you how you want to deal with the situation. You know, do you want to look at it as you've made it, or do you want to look at it as a great opportunity to see what football can bring for you? And I'm pleased with how I got my head down. I kind of do what feels right. I didn't really think about it. I turned up very excited, very interested in how Premier League players, how the stars, you know, that I grew up watching did things. And, you know, I didn't have a set route. I didn't see how I was going to make it. I just thought I'm just going to give it my all. You know, I'm going to die trying, and whether it takes me, you know, whether that meant that I'd eventually see my contract out at City and sign for a League Two or League One club, then so be it. You know, I'd keep fighting and keep trying to play to the best I could.
And were there players there who you admired, who you spoke to? Who are the players, looking back on it now, who perhaps influenced you in some way and how?
I think everyone was great there. You know, I signed the same day as Paul Dickoff signed for the second time for the club. And he was absolutely awesome to me. He, you know, with the greatest respect, he didn't know who I was, but he knew that I'd signed. He knew that Stuart Pearce had faith in me. And he knew how difficult it was. You know, he'd moved from wherever he'd moved from in Scotland one day to England. He knew that I wasn't from the, you know, Shrewsbury's not the most busy, or it's not a city. And he understood that I was going to need people like him showing me the right direction. So it was a friendly arm. Nicky Weaver was absolutely fantastic with me. Casper, you know, we were the same age. Casper was, you know, one of the best keepers in the Premier League. Now was at City at the time, and he was so good with me, made me feel welcome, and you know, we've got a lasting relationship till now. People like Trevor Sinclair, you know, just and the foreign guys. It was interesting to me to see foreign footballers. I've never seen a foreign footballer till I signed for Manchester City, and you know, the different cultures and different ways people did things. So it was all good for me.
Joe Hart, the Offside Rule exclusives.
Yours is obviously a story of persistence at Manchester City, going out on loan a couple of times, coming back. But within that fabric of that story, there's always the champion, and there's always the manager that then gives you that first chance to put on the shirt and be number one. For you, would you say that Sven-Göran Eriksson has been a big influencer in your career?
Yeah, I think good and bad, I can say that every single manager I've had, you know, right from... you know, Jimmy Quinn to Gary Peters, and then Stuart. Stuart was huge for me, Stuart Pearce. You know, I only played one game under him as a Man City manager, but for him to take me out of non-league to pay, you know, 600,000 up front to you know, which nowadays means nothing, but then it was, you know, it was asking his chairman to take a chance and spend some money, was huge. Then Sven came in and was fantastic for me. Then Mark Hughes came in. That was, you know, another important time in my career, because I'd gone from playing and being important number one to a new manager coming in and deciding that I wasn't for him. He wanted the experience, so I got moved aside. I had to go back onto the bench and then get myself out to Birmingham, because I thought that was it for me at Man City, because whilst Mark Hughes was there, you know, I wasn't going to play. Then obviously he moved on. I had a great year with Alex McLeish. And then... I didn't know what the plan was from there, but Mancini made it clear that he wanted me back. He saw great potential in me, you know, and that worked out well. We worked well together. He finished, Manuel came in. Another experience of me being left out of the team after being in the team for a long, long time. I thought he was great with how he did it, got me back in the team. We won the Premier League again, you know, and then Pep came in, made it clear that, again, I wasn't for him, so I had to go and find somewhere new to play. I really enjoyed my time in Torino last year, and I'm enjoying my time with West Ham.
Speaking with professionals, often when they're at sort of your level, you'd say that they know they've had the rejection. There's no way you get to the level that you are in your career and you've not had some rejection along the way, and I think that's probably across the board. But the thing that you must battle with is if you're not given the chance, because there's having a go and showing what you can do and then someone deciding, actually, I prefer doing it this way. But under a couple of those managers, it was really difficult for you to get a chance, and on the latter occasion, you never even did.
Yeah, but that's... That's life and that's football. We all want a fair chance at everything, but that's not how it works. And me waiting for that to happen and wait for a fair shot at things, that's not the industry. I've been in it for a long, long time now. And maybe when I was, 22, when Mark Hughes did it, it made me a lot angrier than it did this time, because I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to cope with it. You know, football was just starting to fall for me. Things were starting to happen. And it was a real shock when I was told no. But now, you know, lots of things have happened to me in my life. Lots of interesting things, not just football. My life isn't just football. I've had rejections. I've had, you know, interesting things happen to me. So when this situation happened, I'm all up for a fight. A fair fight is good for me. And if I lose, I'll shake hands with my opposition. But I realised that maybe this wasn't going to be my opportunity for a good fight. So I looked elsewhere. There was no point in getting upset or getting irate because at the end of the day, there was only one winner. There was a guy that Man City had put in charge with a lot of power because they'd fought like hell to get him as their number one manager. So, you know, he had decisions to make. He made his decision with me. So we shook hands and we moved on.
Many who relate Pep's career to his great times at Barcelona might see the irony in the statement that I'm about to say, which is you played for Manchester City it was a last 16, round of 16 tie for Manchester City against Barcelona. And in that, not only did you do the one thing that not many people can say they've done, which is save a penalty taken by Lionel Messi, which is one thing, but you also in that match went on, you made 10 saves. I think that was a record in a match, like 10 brilliant saves. And that player, the player that we talk about for Ballon d'Ors, comes out afterwards and says, you're a phenomenon. You know, there's an irony in all of that, that his link's there, the fact that the world's best player is saying that you are brilliant.
Yeah, there is. But, you know, that was for me personally that night, it was a great duel, especially with one of the greatest players, if not the greatest players to play the game. But he goes through those duels weekly, you know, because he's testing goalkeepers. And he wins the majority of the time, but, you know, my performance wasn't a one-off. I'm sure he's experienced times when he just can't score past a goalkeeper. So it was a good moment. It was more frustrating for me that it wasn't enough in the tie. We didn't win the tie. But I don't look at it ironically. It was a moment. It was a memory. But in terms of comparing it to, you know, the manager of Man City now, it doesn't interest me in comparing it to him. I'm just, you know, I'll do my career and other people will do their own. And I'll see where it takes me.
Was that your best ever match?
No, because we didn't. We lost, and we lost the tie. So I had a lot to do, and I made some. It was on a big stage, you know, to do those things at the Camp Nou, in a Champions League, gets a lot of people's attention. But I've had other games that I find more important because it, you know, I affected the game for us to win it.
I'm just going to round off on Pep because I'm going to give you my take on it as an external person, and obviously, you know, different. But to me, it feels like there was a statement to be made there. It wasn't just about him creating a team who he believed in. It was about him setting his stall out. And we see it all the time. You know, we're in one of the finance capitals of the world. It happens here all the time. A new manager comes in, a new director, a new FCO, a new CEO comes in, and they make a statement. And they make a statement by taking often someone who's branded, who is Mr. Man City, who does represent a lot of what that club's about, and they make a statement with them. Is it fair to say that Guardiola's statement wasn't about ability and the way that you play or the way that you might fit into his team? There was also a bit about him being the new manager and wanting to be definitive, to kind of make a statement about him being the new manager, about him being in control at that club.
I understand what you're saying, but you know, I'm certainly not going to second guess why. The only thing that I know that came of it was I needed to leave. So why he did it or what the intentions were, I don't really care because it makes no difference to me. It makes no difference to my life because it was the one thing that was important to me was that I wasn't going to play football for Man City anymore. So that's the most important thing to me, whether I was a statement or whether it was just literally a managerial decision is not my problem. My problem is having this short career, trying to play at the top level, and that was going to be jeopardised, so I needed to look elsewhere.
You rather hurriedly had to go to Torino. You didn't have much time, really, to make that move happen, and I'm sure Pete, who's your manager here today, was hurriedly trying to sort things out for you. Tell us a bit about your time at Torino. One thing I've got to say is those tracksuits were awful, Joe. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I saw a couple of videos and I thought I was watching something from the 80s. Mm. Goodness me.
Yeah, we were with the Kappa brand and I was assured that the owner of Kappa was a Torino fan, which made me scratch my head. I don't know if he was. But I had a great year there. Like you said, it came about in a really strange way. You know, I've finally got the definitive answer that I needed to leave Man City very late in the transfer window when, you know, a lot of goalkeeper business had been done. You know, it's one of the first things that gets done. So for people to be able to necessarily afford my, like, you know, budget for my wages or budget for me to come to their club or need me when they've already got probably nearly every team had a nailed on number one goalkeeper, it was tough. So, you know, we were scratching around anywhere we could, and we were so grateful. Well, I was so grateful that Torino put the neck on the line for me. I spoke with the manager. Yeah, I think it was important. I said to my management that I want to speak to any coach that this is involved in, because I didn't want to speak to a chief executive or anything like that. I wanted the coach to want me and want me to play for his team, and I wanted him to hear who and what I represent and what I am, because, you know, it can get very clouded when...
You needed to hear that, didn't you?
Yeah. And, you know, people's opinion probably could get clouded of me because, you know, a lot gets said and a lot gets talked about, and I'm not the kind of guy to, if something bad that gets said about me, to necessarily combat it, because I don't really care what people say about me. But I want to know people that I work with closely. I want them to hear and know what my thoughts are on football, what I want to give to football, who I am and what I am as a team player. So luckily I was able to make that connection, speak with him, and then he gave me a great opportunity to go and experience something new, something, you know, for myself and my family to throw ourselves into. I've always wanted to play abroad, but, you know, that's it would be a lie to say that I didn't want to spend my whole time at Man City. You know, I'd have happily played for them for the rest of my career, and not played abroad, but it seemed like too good an opportunity to turn down when, you know, a couple of days left of the transfer window, it was third or fourth choice at City, or to go and play in Serie A with Torino in a beautiful city. So I took it.
When you're one of the few England players that we've got to speak to that's actually been abroad, because there aren't that many, what is it that you have brought back from the Italian way of doing things?
I've brought back with me a whole lot more respect than I had for the foreign players, for integrating new players into the team. Different ways of playing football, different ideas. I've got an awful lot more understanding of how coaches do things, the ideas. A lot, you know. I'm pretty open-minded anyway, but it really kind of broadened my horizons to how things are done. How much I need to... I've got ways of doing things, but I need to be open to the way other people do things, and I'm more accepting and more driven. It's made me more driven because I went out there, you know, I'm not a robot. I was, of course, nervous going out there. I didn't know how I was going to settle in. New language, new city, everything new. And I loved it. And I didn't feel out of place. I didn't feel out of place with the team. I brought back nothing but good words to say about Italy, nothing but good words to say about Serie A, nothing but good words to say about potentially, you know, if you're ever in a situation where you get the chance to go and play abroad, go for it.
Was it always clear that you'd have to find another club after your time with Torino finished?
Yeah, that was 100%. And I said towards the end of that season that I'd love to assign somewhere permanent. You know, I'm at a point in my life where I want to be set. I want to have goals. I want to be driven. You know, I want to set myself up and be somewhere. But that didn't come around because, you know, whatever the business side of it didn't work out. You know, too much money was put on my head, or people weren't willing to pay it. So another loan came about. You know, I was never going to stay at City. They made it clear. They signed, you know, a world record for a goalkeeper. They'd done more or less the same the year before. They were looking elsewhere. So I was very grateful when West Ham gave me the opportunity to come here for a year. And it's another one of getting my head down, being a West Ham player, and fighting for the cause.
What's it like working with Bilic, and how does that compare with other managers who you've worked with?
I mean, I enjoy working with him. You know, I don't think you can hear a bad word about him, can you, as a person? He's a good man, first and foremost. You know, he's got vast experience, from by all accounts a very good player as well. So I'm trying to help him. I'm trying to give him as much as I can as a senior player who's been around. And, you know, we need to do better as a team, but we're working on that.
Would you like that move here to be made permanent?
At the moment, it's not even on my radar because, you know, I've got way too much going on and way too many things to focus on. I know the only certainty is that I'm going to be here for the season no matter what. So that's my focus. I've not really got time to take my eye off the ball and start thinking long term. I'll have a year left on my contract at the end of this season. So, you know, hopefully it'll be a little bit easier to organise a permanent move somewhere. But, you know, all that's for the summer and hopefully after a good World Cup to be dealt with. So there's way too much on my plate to worry about what I'm going to be doing next season.
You've started something now as well, especially with all your fan base in Asia, because they're all getting the numbers 25. They love numbers out in Asia as well. It's like lucky numbers. And you've gone for number 25 instead of number one, haven't you?
Yeah, it was a number I've enjoyed. It was my first number at City. I won the league in 25. Then I went, you know, in the middle of it, I went to Birmingham, had a good time. And it's a number that I never really wanted to go away from. But, you know, I was advised number one, obviously, is a lot more stronger and more powerful than the statement. And, you know, maybe at the time it was the right thing to do. But when I signed here, 25 was available. Darren Randall still had the number one. So, you know, it was an easy decision for me. And then he went and they've still offered the number one because it was available. But, you know, I'd made my decision and that's what I wanted to be.
The Offside Rule exclusives are available to download for free via Audioboom and iTunes.
Speaking about the career highlight for you at Manchester City, winning the title, I would love to know, and I know Kate would as well, what was it like on the pitch? You know, the Aguero moment. And you're down the other end as well, which makes it even more interesting because I'm guessing you're getting input from the crowd, are you? Are you even listening at that point?
I was in as low a place as the crowd because I was practically a spectator, especially after QPR scored the second goal. We just pummeled them for half an hour, whatever it was. And I was stood with exactly the same feelings as every Manchester City fan. I couldn't believe what we'd done. I couldn't believe we'd messed up after all the hard work we'd done. And yeah, I didn't think it was possible. I didn't think for a second it was possible. Even when Edin scored, you know, they defended so resolutely. There was no way getting through them. And it was just an explosion in me. I don't know why I ran or how I was going to stop. If I hadn't seen Gale, I don't know where I would have stopped. But it's one of the most, you know, spine-chilling moments for me in my life and in my career. And I don't think it will be topped. If it is, then great.
Yeah,
if it is, then great. But as far as feelings go, it was way too special, and I was wiped out. You know, I can't even remember how we celebrated. It wiped me out. It was an emotional day, and yeah, it will live with me for the rest of my life.
Well, also in that particular way, I think it's a common football question, isn't it? Where were you when City won the league? Because I think I was at Sky Sports, and we had a whole team of journalists behind me, and we were, you know, I was covering the matches live, and it was insane because the whole newsroom was glued, and when it went in, and when the realization that you'd won the league, you know, we knew it was huge. It's going to become one of those questions. Where were you when City won the league? Where were you when Liverpool won the Champions League? You know, it's one of those football questions, isn't it?
The second image that I always remember from it was Sir Alex Ferguson's face. You know, that first shot they got. I will never forget that, never. I wonder, we spoke about Ballon d'Or winner Messi earlier. I wonder about your take on Aguero, actually, because you have worked with one of the best strikers in the world and he's continuing to show why he is so good. He seems a little understated. You'll know him as a teammate, but he seems to be the sort of person that doesn't shout too much. Do you think he should be in the list of Ballon d'Or? I know it's been dominated in recent years by Ronaldo and Messi, but is he being overlooked somewhat?
He's not been overlooked, but the other guys just, you know, they're so consistent in, and they back it up with medals and trophies. And I think we all know that if Man City win the Champions League, a lot of it will be down to Kun. You know, if and when that day does happen, it's going to be down to him. So that will be his moment. You know, I don't think anyone will ever question him that he's a world-class player. The two guys you mentioned there, I'm sure that he's on their radar knowing full well that he's a world-class player. I'm sure Kun knows he is. But until you're lifting the Champions League trophy or a World Cup, that's kind of probably the only time you're going to smash past those two because they're so consistent and they're phenomenal players. So, like I say, if and when Man City win the Champions League, that's when Kun will be right up there in the top three for the Ballon d'Or.
And we'll all be ready because they've made it a bit boring now, let's be honest.
As we've alluded to, Carly Telford, who is an England goalkeeper with England Women, has set some questions for you, and she's guest edited the podcast. Every single one of these exclusives is guest edited by a woman to try and get women's voice in football, both men's and women's football out there. Now, she's given us a question here, Jo, and I don't know if she's looking directly for a tip from you, but she said, how do you stay switched on in games, the ones where you may have only three or four touches a half. So I don't know whether this comes on the back of England women dominating teams like Russia recently.
This is like an England-San Marino game, I guess.
Yes. Tell us, how do you stay switched on?
I think, you know, the pitch isn't that big. So it's not like you sat down and all of a sudden someone says, can you just get up and make a save? Or can you, you know, I've always worked with my team and worked with the lines that we're pressing. And it's not easy. But it's something that, whether I'm heavily involved with the TV cameras because you're touching the ball or making saves, but I still feel just as involved even when I'm not. So for me, just staying, using the same movements, working with the back four, seeing danger and preparing for it, even if it doesn't happen, is the best way for me.
From that point of view, some people would say, you know, you look at Hugo Lloris at Spurs and he's captain, and some would say there's pros and there's cons to having involvement all the time in the match or being the goalkeeper and perhaps being brought into play every now and again. Do you think that a goalkeeper can make a good captain?
Yeah, of course, because I don't think the actual captain's role in football isn't the same on the pitch as it is in cricket. Or you know, cricket probably is my strongest influence, because the actual captain is making decisions constantly. He's changing the ball in attack. He's changing the field. But football, you kind of, your captaincy role is more organising the players before, keeping, you know, being the link between the players and the management. On the pitch, you kind of have to govern yourself. You know, I've captained on the pitch before, and you almost, when you speak with the referee, you nominate a player that if you can't be there, that will speak on your behalf. So Hugo Lloris is a fantastic captain. He leads by example. You know, the bits that you see on the TV are probably like 2-3% of what his captaincy is and what his importance to the club. So, you know, whether he's able to actually talk with the ref and run the length of the field, or whether, you know, someone like Harry, for instance, will probably be the nominated guy for Tottenham to speak to the ref if Hugo, you know, if it's, you know, a 50-yard sprint, he's not going to do it. So Harry will take the power on the pitch, but Hugo's the captain on and off the field.
We know that you work with coach Dave Watson at Birmingham, and he came into the England setup with you as well. I know he, you know, credits those as some wonderful times working with you and getting the chance to help you show what you can do on an international stage. Hugely satisfying for him as a coach. And I know that you have a strong bond with Dave as well. But lately there's been some criticism around your England performances. And I think if you're probably honest, you'll look back at certain tournaments and say, well, actually, yes, I perhaps could have done better there. What's the intention for you as far as your England career goes?
I want to do something with it. It's great. You know, I'm very proud to strap on the jersey every time. And I'm proud to cross the white line. You know, I represent myself, my family, my friends, and my club. But I want it to mean something. I want it to count for something. You know, I've qualified for every tournament that I've set out for, and I intend to do that again, which will get overlooked, and, you know, which won't be seen as a great thing to do. But that's important, you know. And then once we qualify, I need to do something with that career. I want to amass as many caps as I can. I want to be, you know, the goalkeeper playing for England, but I want, more than anything, I'd swap them all for a trophy or a role in an important summer for the nation. So that's my only intention when I play for England.
So is it fair to say there's some unfinished business there for you in terms of your England career?
I think there's unfinished business for all of us, apart from, you know, the guys who from 66. You know, there's been obviously a lot stronger tournaments than I've been involved in since then, but the hopes and dreams as an England player, once you get your first cap, which, you know, is an amazing feeling, especially when it wasn't something that was I didn't dream about, because I didn't, you know, it wasn't something I needed to dream about because I didn't think it was possible. So once that happened, the next thing and the most important thing is to do something with your England career and make it matter. And you know, I've failed ultimately up until now, so I need to change that.
It's quite strong from you. I'm going to ask you about some of your England managers. I'm just intrigued about Fabio Capello. It was a while ago.
I know.
Bit of an odd personality.
I know exactly what she's going to say. In terms of this podcast, we have all the time, no one knows whether it's me speaking or whether it's Kate. Okay. And I know that Kate had this story that she heard, and you can clarify whether this is true, whether the first few times he met you, he called you John.
Well, I was called consistently John.
Consistently,
which infuriated me. But then I moved to Italy, and they call me John.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was smashing my head against the wall because I thought it was a total disrespect, and they thought my name was John. But someone explained to me that Gianluca is how they'd associate Joe. Because Joe's not good. Joseph, I think they'd get their head around Joseph, but Joe's just such a nothing name to a foreign person. It's short for something, or it might even be Giuseppe or whatever. And so John Art was how I was known. But I thought it was, at the time especially, because I'd not really dealt with a foreign manager, especially a non-speaking foreign staff. You know, Fabio didn't speak great English. He did in the end, but the guys didn't, none of the staff spoke very good English. So I just thought, you know, and I was third choice goalkeeper the majority of the time that I was there, and almost a spare part with how the working went, because it was a lot of 11v11s, and then, you know, the spare, the three people left over from the squad and the third choice keeper, we just went off and they just pummeled shots at me. So I couldn't get my head around it, but now all these years later, I understand it was just their best way of saying Joe.
Was that what you were thinking, Kate?
Yes, it was. My mind cast back to 2010 in the World Cup, and Capello choosing Rob Green to go in goal, and you're on the bench, David James is on the bench, and David James is sat there and he's thinking, why hasn't Joe got this? You know, and that's David James. Is it fair to say that that was probably very frustrating? Nothing against Rob, of course, but a very frustrating time in your career, because here you are, you're playing for England, this manager's come in and you're not getting your chance.
I was absolutely doing cartwheels to go and be involved in a World Cup, and one that I thought was going to be... I wanted to play, of course I wanted to play. I didn't have many games. I think I only had 3 games previous to that. So it was a big call. It was a big call for the manager, but I thought Rob had come into the World Cup in good form. He'd had a strong season, you know, and he had one of those moments that we've all had, and, you know, a lot of storm came around it, because it's an important time for them. You know, I've experienced it myself. I had it, you know, I probably should have saved the second goal against Iceland, and you've just got to deal with those situations in your career. You don't want them, but...
How do you deal with them? How do you go about that? Because, of course, we all think back to Iceland as the kind of last major game. And obviously it signified England's exit from Euro 2016. How do you deal with it?
You just have to. It's part of the career. It's part of life. It's sad and it's disheartening. It's not even sad on a personal thing. You know, I've been called every name under the sun. I don't think anyone could insult me and it would make me angry anymore. I really don't, because... not really interested in a lot of people's opinions. There's very few people that I hold dearly to my heart who can affect me, football and family-wise. But it hurt more that it affected the good supporters, the people who'd come out there, and it affected the squad. It affected because we left a tournament that we should have got a lot further in.
Would you turn up if you were third choice goalkeeper?
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why?
It's an interesting question, because I think what some people don't know about you is how you will live and die for football, for playing, for having the opportunity, for never feeling like you're too big or too little in that setup. I think it's always worth reminding people that it is about the football. It is about being there, part of that England camp, as much as it is about winning trophies.
Yeah, I love being part of that England squad. And it's at its peak of that for me. You know, I love being around the players, the environment, the talent, the skill. And I want to be a part of it. I don't care how. Obviously, I'd be lying if I said I don't want to play every game and I don't want to influence every game. But, you know, that might not be possible in my career. But I'm going to be there. I'm going to put myself on the line for the team, on the line for the manager. And I'm going to help in any way I can.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Offside Rule TV, for exclusive video football content.
Obviously, we are a female-fronted football podcast. We like to try and point out the times when women are getting involved and the good things going on as well. What's it been like for you observing the women's game, but also women within football as well? Obviously, City have a very involved women's team that really exploded out of nowhere after, you know, City's investment in players like you, where they very, very heavily invested and achieved success. It appears that the same's happened for the women's side as well. So what's your take on kind of women? Do we need to get them more involved? Is it a positive thing? Do we need to do more?
Well, like you say, I've been around, you know, one of the most impressive setups I've seen in football, and I don't mean that just in the women's game. I thought it was brilliant, and I can't speak highly enough of the owners of Manchester City about the way they went about what they did. And they took over a club, and they took over a community. They took over a really important way of looking at football, the way Manchester City fans, the relationship that they've got with Manchester, and to invest, you know, football, women's football was on the rise, but there was no one told them, put a gun to their head and said, you need to make the youth academy better, you need to build this, you need to do this. But they invested heavily, and the talent is phenomenal, and the girls are great. You know, we got to work with them, and you know, we supported each other, and you know, that's leaked right the way through to having links with the national team. The national team's getting a lot more coverage on TV. There's nothing better than seeing England do well in anything, and we're one of the strongest nations in the world.
Was there any lessons that the men's team learnt from the women's team, or any observations of the women's team that you picked up on?
No, it's hard to say lessons, but it's great to win, isn't it? You know, and it's great to have the backing of your country. We're very lucky because, you know, a lot of bad stuff gets said about the England national team because a lot of the negative stuff is given a lot more light and is given a lot more attention than the numerous positive messages we receive, the numerous young fans, you know, the numerous families who support you around the world. When we travel, the negative stuff is more fun and is more headline. So it's nice to see what a special country we are when the team does well, you know. And I don't expect the public to get behind us if we don't do well, because, you know, there's literally no point. But every tournament I've turned up to, we've had amazing support. Every away match that I've played for England and home match has had, you know, stronger support than I've seen anywhere in the globe. So it just made me even more excited for when that time does come when we do well at the tournament. I'm really going to enjoy it.
And what does happen then as well is that you have, as you're going to have now, as after we finish this interview, is you're going to be flocked for selfies from fans who can't wait to get the camera phones out and all that. We'll be like doing the same, wanting to get a picture in a second, by the way. But also, just to end on the brand note, coming back to it, because aren't you now the master of selfies? Aren't you doing some stuff for some travel?
Yeah,
I've just, you can show us a thing or two.
It's not, to be honest, it's not my forte. But you know, Sharon Latham. I don't know if you know her. She was a photographer at Manchester City for years. You know, a huge, huge personality, and she's a really, really close friend of mine. And she's a really talented lady, really, really talented lady. And she's done a lot of work. She finished her time with Man City, and she had this idea about, you know, selfies are probably the most done thing in social media, done thing on smartphones nowadays. So she had this idea of, you know, people, it frustrated her because she's such a great photographer and she would never let you take a picture. She'd always, no, you have to do it this way or do it that way. So when she had the idea of, you know, people go to all these great places, we see all the important landmarks all around the world, she had the idea that of making it easy, literally making it easy for someone to get the perfect selfie. So phenomenal story. I'm sure more will come with it because it's her baby. I'm just helping her with it, but definitely someone interesting to listen to, and definitely something interesting to look out for, and hopefully it's going to help people create some memories.
And on that note,
well, I definitely need her help because I'm the worst selfie taker in the world, as Lindsay will pay testament to. I can never get them right. Joe, thank you so much for talking to us, for setting a few things straight, and also for sharing some of your experiences as well. We're going to go off and take some selfies with you, if that's okay. I'm hoping you've got all the answers. Exactly. We need to ring Sharon. On that note, it's over and out with Joe Hart on this Offside Rule exclusive.
The Offside Rule Exclusives is produced by Offside Productions and edited by Lucy Lavery.
Well, a huge thank you to Joe Hart for taking part in this Offside Rule exclusive. And thanks also to England goalkeeper Carly Telford for guest editing this episode and to Hilton Hotels for accommodating us. You can head over on YouTube to the Offside Rule TV and hit subscribe because we'll be posting videos from all of our Offside exclusives. Our next episode with Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank is out on the 1st of November.